Welcome to the third Unfound team episode. Today you get to hear from Eric, my assistant who was actually a guest first in 2017 before becoming an assistant in 2018. We talk about going to the same college. We discuss how he started his own true crime website, how he became acquainted with Unfound, and how he got his doctorate. Yes, really. And a bunch of other stuff. Next Monday, March 11th, I will release the last team episode, when you will hear from Cherie. Before the talk with Eric starts, I'm sending out a request to all of you. I would love to add you to the team I already have if you have a strong background in one of the following areas: marketing, online retail, website building. If so, email me at unfoundpodcast@gmail.com, in which you tell me a little bit about yourself while also giving me a quick rundown of your experience. This would be a volunteer position, but as any of the current assistants will tell you, all I ask any of them is to devote a couple hours a week to whatever their expertise is. That's it. Okay, then, the interview.
I'm so happy to have on this interview Assistant Eric Grabowski, a fellow Grove City College graduate. I think it was, what, class of 97, Eric?
Yes, it was January 97. I studied at Grove City for 4.5 years and completed my Bachelor of Science in Business Management there and graduated, walked in by January of 97. I don't remember exactly when the commencement was, but the graduation is listed as January 97.
And Eric is also, like myself, grew up in Western Pennsylvania. Although we were not necessarily near each other, I was up there in Armstrong County, and you were down closer to Pittsburgh. What, kind of on the southeast side of Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, what we call in there the Sat Hills in Pittsburgh, and that was the Whitehall Borough area, and maybe about give or take 5 to 10 miles from the city limits, and just there in that first wave of suburbs and towns south of the city. So.
Okay. What high school did you go to?
Baldwin High School, which is the Baldwin-Whitehall school district, and went to St. Gabriel, the Sorrowful Virgin Catholic grade school and public high school, and then, as you said, on to Grove City College. So.
Okay. And, yes, if anybody's wondering, Eric and I were at Grove City at the same time. But no, I'm sure we passed somewhere, like somewhere in the Hicks Hall, in the cafeteria or somewhere. But we did not know each other, and we did not actually meet until 2017. And we're going to get into that. I do want to explore a few things, Eric, just about going back to that time. How did you end up at Grove City? I was practically forced to go there. How did you end up going there?
Yeah, I was thinking about college, and I was pretty set and just discussing with my parents that I was going to go to college. And of course, I was also playing high school football. And so the option of playing football was, small college. I was not a great football player. I was decent, and I had a little bit of size enough to play, but it wasn't going to be at a, major college. I didn't have unrealistic dreams there. And I was at least as much as a high schooler could be somewhat interested in the educational side too. So, Grove City was on my list, and it certainly was known to be a good school.
Yeah.
And it was, in that Western PA, Eastern Ohio, Northern Western Virginia corridor, there's a lot of schools, a lot of small schools. So Grove City kind of stands out. And, as conversations went on and had a visit and was talking to the coach and learning more about it, at some point I made the decision to go there. And sort of the rest is history. Showed up there in August of 1992 and was done by, January of 97. So, and again, it was a Bachelor of Science in Business Management. And then I worked for about 3 years professionally, and some different jobs, but then I had this inclination at some point that I wanted to be in academia and teach at a university and pursue some of the interests that I always had and ideas and so forth. And I ended up studying at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, and ended up getting a master's in communication and then a PhD in rhetoric, and which is sort of a grounding in the classical study of communication, even moving into contemporary issues, and finished the PhD in 2010. I was done with coursework by about 05, but of course the dissertation process and everything that goes with that. By then, I had been working full-time teaching and living in North Dakota. But so yeah, I studied at Duquesne roughly around 2000 to 2010. I had taken a class or two preliminary at Duquesne in 99, I think it was. But basically, my graduate years were that 2000 to 2010. And yeah, I mean, it was a good choice. Obviously, as we all know, academia, like any workplace, has its ups and downs, sometimes more ups, sometimes more downs. But it's been a great opportunity for me, and it's a path I'm glad I chose for the big picture.
So just so everybody understands, when it comes to Grove City College, there's about 2,200 students there. And it's a private college, although it's really, compared to most private schools, not very expensive. Even to this day, when you get into that, there people start thinking Eric and Ed went to private colleges. Wow. Well, when I went in there, I think it was like $8,000 a year or something. I mean, it was
It
really,
was one of the selling points. When you go to Division III sports, you're limited on the sorts of financial perks that you can get for athletics. So, it wasn't as if I was getting this sort of full ride thing. So affordability played a role. And certainly one of the selling points of Grove City for me and my parents was that, you had a reasonable price. So, and certainly there were some financial aid options. Of course, those were different because, as we know, Grove City, at least at the time, and I think it's still the case, is completely private, like a small number of schools were since. So they don't take certain monies, they're not under certain provisions. And not that there weren't financial aid options that one couldn't pursue, but big picture, the affordability provided a strong private education. And I also will say, in gratitude to Duquesne, most of my tuition at Duquesne, because I was a grad assistant, teaching and research assistant. And of course, you get great experience with that, and you work hard, and it's and you get good mentorship through that. A lot of much of my graduate school experience was funded through being a grad assistant. So even Duquesne, which is expensive,
It is.
being a grad assistant allowed me to fund the majority of that through what's called tuition remission. So that was a great opportunity too.
And if people want to know, coincidentally, my mother went to Duquesne and was a music. She graduated there in 62, 1962, with a degree in music. So we've
And
got
they
this
have
whole
a very
Grove
good
City
music
Duquesne
legacy.
thing going on here, Eric.
And they have a very good music legacy at Duquesne,
So then, within all of that, what are your first memories? Like, I've talked about, I've been asked this question many times about my first memories of being interested kind of in true crime or stuff like that. What are your first memories of, and why do you think that you were drawn to that in your life?
Thinking back to when I was just younger coming up, and always had an interest in shows, and I think on the Michael Lanko episode you asked about shows like Unsolved Mysteries and so forth. And yeah, I always liked those programs. And getting interested in what I guess sometimes are called procedural dramas, sometimes, right, where they take you through the steps of how the crime was committed. So obviously Law and Order would later become the big one, but before that there were other shows. Looking back, and I can't remember exactly in my youth how much I watched Columbo, but of course years later you look back and see, it wasn't the only show, but shows like Columbo And some of those sort of were impactful on sort of impacting sort of some of those generic or genre elements of those show. I'm not saying that's the first, but that was certainly impactful. And so I definitely always have had an interest in that, and more in terms of quote unquote real life. I like to think as a citizen, when you know, with documentaries, of course, well before internet, TV, and then of course with later with the net, you know, you see a lot of documentaries, and we've agreed on this so many times in conversation. It's not about the sensationalism. It's not about the morbidity of all this. It really is about the justice component. It's about the families and friends of the deceased or the missing. It is about, and again, whatever guest this was years ago that mentioned this on one of your shows, maybe resolution's not the, you know, maybe resolve rather than closure might be a word. People can debate that. But that notion resonated with me, whoever said that on one of your shows. And I think that, the beauty of Unfound and some of the other endeavors that we on the team do, even outside of Unfound, I think one of the glue that makes our team work well is that commitment to resolution, that commitment to justice, that commitment to the people. This isn't about sensationalism. This isn't about clicks. So I like to think, and of course, like I've granted before, we all kind of get, you know, the media is around us and it gets our attention and we see what's popular. But I think cutting through that and getting serious about there are real people involved in these things, even when it is the procedural dramas on TV and all these sorts of things, it has to resonate with reality in some way for it to be, quote unquote, entertaining. It's touching on something that we care about culturally. These are unresolved, unconcluded situations that people are in. And so there's a level of commitment that goes with that. So I think, you know, I always had that sort of general interest. And then, of course, you know, as I got, you know, around 2010, 2011, as I had mentioned to you in years past, you know, when I started to think, okay, what are some things, you know, I do a little, you know, consulting and freelancing anyway, in public relations, marketing, so forth. But I was thinking through branching out and, you know, what are some areas that I might be able to cultivate and apply some of my talents. And, you know, I started to think a little bit about cold case journalism and, you know, doing that. Again, my full-time work, my primary trade is that of a communication professor. And again, let me just give the usual disclaimers, right? My views here don't necessarily represent that of my employing institution. But, you know, I thought I like research. I certainly like working with people, communicating with people, networking. I've mentioned on many occasions, my main hobby is amateur genealogy, and I've had some success with family history research over the years, and that is something I try to bring to discussions, as you know, of cold cases and missing persons and so forth. And so I try to refine and cultivate that interest, and, you know, 2012 is when I started to delve into the first case I delved into with some depth was a murder case still unsolved, the Larry Phoebus case, which in terms of the Attorney General's website in North Dakota is listed as the oldest cold case on record. And Larry was, the time frame on that was 62 to 63, probably murdered in 62 and then still unsolved to this day. And then through our interactions, you know, as I've explained before in the Michael Anko episode, you know, it was sort of right after, and it was in the late 2016 that I reached out to you.
Right.
We started discussing, and you kind of opened the door and said, well, you know, what do you want to run with? And I ran more with that Donna's case, and we had the episode, and through, you know, some of my own endeavors and then through having the opportunity to get involved on the team here in Unfound later, which was has been great. It's provided an opportunity to really apply and talk about research and help you and the team on some specific cases, more in the background. You know, some of the other team members, as I always like to say, do a lot more than I do, but I've certainly contributed to some of those cases that you were building episodes for, and we're still working on some of those things. And so, I think for me, looking back, it's been an opportunity to take what was sort of a general interest and refine it in some ways to be a small contributor, and still run, I think, with some other cases. I try to situate most or all of my missing persons interests through the prism of Unfound, because it's just such a big and impactful platform. And then there are, a couple other cases that I pursue outside of that, research and networking. So that's.
Yeah, I want to go back maybe just back to, like, of course, usually when I think about the internet, I think about it got getting started about 90, I'm going to say I got my first computer about 95, was on the internet maybe late 95, 96. Can you remember going back to that time? If you're interested in true crime, do you remember maybe some of the first cases you ended up looking up, on the internet, once the internet became a thing? I will give you, just to give you an example, one of the first disappearances I ever looked up on the internet when it became a thing was Jody Husentrude. Of course, she disappeared right when the internet was kind of becoming a thing for me. And then, like, the next year, of course, TWA 800, with all the conspiracy theories of that plane blowing up, that was something else. There was really a landmark for me, because I've always had an interest in plane crashes. Those are a couple of things early on for me in the internet. Is there anything maybe that you remember going back and being interested in looking something up, maybe in Western, or it's from the Western Pennsylvania area or anywhere else?
So my recollection of the internet as we know it today, because as we know, in the 80s into the 90s, people had dial-up, and there were bulletin board systems, and those were networked into larger packets of whatever communication they were doing. I remember in the mid to late 90s, where it was becoming more normative, where people could sit down and quote unquote surf the web. Okay. And so from the late 90s into the 2000s, probably in the 2000s, in my grad school years, whether it be for the sake of time or focus, I probably didn't research any cases specifically, but I do remember now, and this was even pre-YouTube, into then the YouTube era, more interest developing among people on either snippets of documentaries or cases being featured. Or, it was just a heightened media exposure, because we were kind of getting used to more of this stuff being at our fingertips. It probably was not until after 2010 when I started to say, okay, I want to not just watch some of this stuff on TV or the internet, or hear some stuff on radio and do a little follow-up. Because I love a radio person. I like AM radio, FM radio, talk shows, all sorts of topics. Then it's now saying, what could I specifically research? I can't say for sure what the first was in terms of any deeper reading, but I can think of the first case that I said I want to get serious about. I would say it would be that Larry Phoebus case, and that would have been again around by 2012-ish.
What about going back to your childhood? Once again, my example for me being from, north of Pittsburgh, disappearance that's still unsolved, and we've not yet covered it on Unfound, but that was Sherry Mahan, a little girl who went missing from the Saxonburg area in about 1985, which really, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes from where I grew up. Anything that you remember that from your childhood, like the Baldwin area, anything like that, any disappearances that really caught your attention, maybe from your parents? We got to watch a little Eric a little bit more, anything like that?
Well, two things on that. In terms of media, it wasn't a disappearance; it was a death, a murder. And I haven't followed it closely over the years to know what's been learned about it. But Unsolved Mysteries covered the death of Michael Rosenblum, and
That name
so
sounds familiar.
this would have been in the 80s, and that it happened. And I don't remember the exact year. It was featured at some point on Unsolved Mysteries, and it was one of those cases that had some national traction anyway. And the location of that, okay, involved sort of an area that was sort of a crossover area, and even involved the possibility of, because that area where it happened was sort of a border area of sort of City of Pittsburgh, Baldwin borough, et cetera. And so it had some strong local interest. So that Michael Rosenblum case stands out.
Okay.
I've not done a lot of real close reading on that over the years. But
is that still solved, or is that still, or what do you know?
You know, I don't know. I don't want to comment because I've not kept up on what answers and what inquiries and what journalistic endeavors. But that was a case that certainly was receiving national attention.
Okay.
And then and in terms of missing, the discussion of missing kids and so forth, coming up in the 80s as a younger person through grade school, there was a heightened awareness of precautionary measures and with, you know, discussions with parents, like, you know, it's beyond don't talk to strangers. It's, you know, having a code word if someone comes up to you. We didn't, you know, I certainly had that with my parents, and being proactive about those things. You know, that was about the time where there was heightened media awareness and conversational and educational awareness about protecting kids from abductions and so forth.
Right.
And certainly growing up in the 80s, you know, that was certainly something that was on our minds in those days. And certainly my parents and I and others around me, educators and so forth, were more conscientious about that. Because as you recall, being a little bit older, that was a pretty frequent discussion in media, news media, you know, investigative journalism, entertainment media. I mean, all that notion of the abducted child was part of our thoughts coming out of that era.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly right. I remember all of that. Yes. All right. So we have Michael Rosenblum. I'm sure somebody's going to hear that, and they're going to be there looking it up right now. See, is this murder? So that was a murder case. So he was a young boy or something who was murdered?
You know, I don't remember the age, but he was a younger man, or I don't remember if he was late teens, early 20s. And in fact, over the years, I've had some intentions to do a little more reading on it. And I haven't. But it is a case that stands out because it was covered by Unsolved Mysteries when Robert Stack was still on there. Yeah.
Right. And so it kind of hit home. There you have a national show.
We're
and they're talking about something that's, you know, very close to your
area. And right on that border area of Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you have your career. You have your career to fill. And you eventually get your doctorate. I know I've probably asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again now that this is being recorded. What is you to get your doctorate? What is your dissertation? What was it on?
So the title of my dissertation is Russell Kirk and the Rhetoric of Order. And Russell Kirk was a 20th century movement conservative thinker. He was a colleague. Colleague's not the right word. Sort of a fellow traveler. Of the early Bill Buckley and others. And, you know, he was sort of involved in the discussion of political discourse in the 50s and the 60s and lived until the 90s. And, you know, I had the opportunity there after I was done with coursework at Duquesne to have a fellowship at the Kirk Center and Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal in Mecosta, Michigan. And that was sort of because Kirk, although he did do some work at universities over the years in colleges, he was really in some ways an independent man of letters. And so he was had this ancestral home in this small town in Michigan. So having that opportunity gave me a chance to get going on some of that work, as well as look for a job at the time. And it was a good opportunity to get moving. So that dissertation is in some ways about political communication and rhetoric, as well as some discussion about rhetoric and philosophy and communication ethics and natural law, some things that Kirk was interested in, and then used that to branch out into some things pertaining to rhetoric and communication studies. So,
how long did it take you to do that, to get your doctorate? I know you went through that before, but
I
just
started, so if you count, so I coursework from 2002 up till 2010 July when I defended. We're looking at about 8 years.
Yeah, well, it's good you put in 8 years and then you had to defend it. I'm glad you defended it well, Eric. I would hate to.
That's the thing. The challenge of a PhD, just like any significant endeavor, is seeing through those steps. from coursework to comprehensive exams to then proposing a dissertation topic and then really seeing it through. And again, thanks to my faculty at Duquesne for providing good mentorship and push along the way. So,
So just to give you an idea, of course, Unfound isn't even 8 years old yet. So working on this took you longer to do that. And that's not a criticism. It's very, very difficult. What do I know about getting a doctorate? Nothing. But it, you're getting your talk took longer than the age of Unfound. It just shows you how hard the work is and everything. It took some time.
Sure. Sure. And it took, you know, looking back, as I always say, you know, it took longer than I planned, and that is what it is. But then I always sort of, quote unquote, spin that positively and say, look, the extra time, I think it turned out to be a better project than I originally intended. Again, thanks to good mentorship from Duquesne faculty, but it all turned out well in the end. So,
yeah. Is that you becoming a professor? Is that something you always wanted to do going back? Or did you have other plans for your life? Then when you got to college, you changed them? Or what was it? I have to admit that I really never knew what I wanted to do with my life for a long time. So I tried a bunch of different things and enjoyed it. What about you?
It was a shift. You know, I always liked ideas. I liked mixing it up in discourse. And as you know, I'm a bit of a political junkie. But when I was finishing my degree at Grove City, I wanted to be in the business world, you know, whether that was in management or sales or marketing. And I did the sales or marketing for about 3 years. But at some point, close to 1999, I don't remember the exact time, I had this inclination to follow some of my interests and ideas. And there were different influences, and not to get into all of them here, but it got me thinking, okay, a way to pursue this is to be part of the university life and to pursue that academic role. So even by the time I said, okay, I'm going to get this master's degree at Duquesne, I was pretty strongly leaning toward, I'm going to keep pushing through and get a PhD and so forth. I wanted to do the academic path. That was a shift, because when I was in undergrad, I really didn't have a strong interest in doing grad school. You know, I was more inclined to do work in the marketplace, which isn't a bad path for some people. Yeah. I just changed paths. And certainly those experiences that I had still were formative, and I had some great mentors in the business world, and still some of that can inform my teaching, and I've still continued to do on the side little bits of consulting here or there, freelancing and marketing or PR. So, you know, what I did then in some ways corresponds to my academic studies, although in some ways it was a very different path, but not completely.
Okay. So let's now move up. You said you got your doctorate in 2010, and like in 2011, maybe you now had some time to look up that murder. I'm guessing, yeah. Of course, at some point you became interested in the disappearance of Donna Mikulenko, which is really how we first met. Not long before we did this interview, you'd sent me that original email that you sent to me from way back when, and kind of our back and forth and everything. Let's talk, if everybody wants to get into Donna Mikulenko's disappearance, they can go back and find that episode on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever. But do you remember the first time you came across her disappearance?
It was, so I had the Phoebus case research going by 2012, pretty relative to my overall life then significantly. And I was thinking, okay, And again, part of this was sort of blending in my networking, including with you. Mm-hmm. And there was an open door there in our conversations to say, hey, you know, if there's something you want to pursue, maybe we can talk about the possibility of an episode. Mm-hmm. And then with that, you know, continuing to delve more deeply into sort of in the region, what some of the cases were. Donna's case seemed fitting. Mm-hmm. To say, hey, this is a missing persons program, and it would make sense to dig more deeply into this. And so I would say that open door added an opportunity or a motivation. So I kind of really strongly ran with it, as you recall, in terms of old media and networking with family and talking to some people in the region and just kind of seeing what was out there. And the rest is history. And again, folks can look at that, the Donna Mikulenko Close to Home.
Right.
Is it Close to Home? I want to get that right for the listeners.
I forget what the
Out of
title
the
of the
Dark. Out of the Dark.
Out of the
Mix
Dark.
of
That's right. Now I remember.
The Suchi case, which is, I've taken a great interest in.
Right.
That was close to home. So
That's right.
Out of the Dark, Donna Michelenko.
Right.
And so I really dug deeply into that. And so that really was yours and was a great opportunity. Of course, that was before I joined the team, but that was sort of our big lead in into my relationship as a guest with Unfound. And then you and I kept the conversations going, and which has led us to where we are today.
Right.
And then over the years, there's been a few other cases separate from Unfound, particularly murders that I've pursued and done some research here and there. But again, the majority or all of my interest in missing persons has been with Unfound, which, and we can talk about this later if you want. Unfound is just a wonderful vehicle for networking and building collaboration with people who listen to Unfound or who reach out to you and you reach out to them. It's a crossroad.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks. It's very nice of you to say that, Eric. Now, listeners should know of the current assistants I have now, Eric is the only one that I've officially met in person, and we've met maybe three times in person, maybe.
Yeah,
can't be more than four, but I think it's more than two or something, somewhere in there.
Yeah, we met when we were both in the area and had some
Pennsylvania
and got to know each other in person,
right.
And we had great rapport from a distance, and
right.
We talked about ideas and about marketing the program and just about life in general.
That's right. So we maybe met, I'm going to say at most three times, but they've all been in Pennsylvania when we've happened to have been back there at the same time. We were both back in Pennsylvania there in December, but just could not make it happen. Everybody has to understand where my dad lives now and where Eric goes to see his father. They're really not that close to each other. Kind of on opposite sides of Pittsburgh. In fact, my dad lives nowhere near Pittsburgh, I guess. So there's that.
So
But he, Eric and I have
planning.
Met. Excuse me?
I was going to say, when we get together, there's some logistical planning involved.
That's right. That's exactly right. Good. That's a good way to put it. Now, as far as true crime podcasting, before you ever contacted me, were there other podcasts that were like on your, list, like going back to 2013, 2014, 2015? Did you listen to, for example, as everybody knows, and it's a big joke, I've never listened to the podcast Serial. Is that something that you were into back? Did you ever listen to that or any of these others like Generation Y that existed well before Unfound came out? Well, what was your status as far as your connection to like social media and podcasting, true crime podcasting, before you and I ever met? What was your connection?
Much of my interest at that time was still in traditional media. That is to say, again, like AM radio, granted by that time, you'd see snippets of documentaries or full documentaries on the net too. But some of that stuff was being generated through traditional media, even if it spilled over into the net. I have to say, off the top of my head, I can't say that I was an enthusiast of any particular program at that time. I would say that I was spending a lot of time looking at some trends, research avenues, what was being discussed, tried or listened to various things, kind of what would come up or pique my interest. I wouldn't say I was an enthusiast, and if I'm forgetting any programs that I did listen to maybe semi-regularly, my apologies to them. And at that time, frankly, I was also thinking about if I were to do this more, what outlets would I use?
Oh, I see.
And of course, I was, when you have a full-time work schedule, you have to kind of think what would really work. And I was sort of grappling with that balance between, well, do I want to launch something or do I want to try to collaborate to find outlets? And we talked about this on the Donna's episode.
Yeah.
And that has helped. And Unfound has been a great vehicle for that for me. Now I do have some concepts that I've never really launched at the level I'd like, coldcaseweb.com, as and I'm going to do more with that. I have some ideas. but I've kind of delayed that for legitimate reasons and sometimes just putting it off and not getting to it. So I will say I was at times thinking more about what are outlets for me, but I would say before that time, it was probably more of a hodgepodge of whatever I could find.
Okay.
There may have been some programs that I did listen to. I did catch some of your early stuff, and
Yeah.
that's really what you piqued my attention. It was a really good approach. Even in the early days, you could tell there was something serious about you were doing, and we had reached out. And as you know,
Yeah.
sometimes in life, and you've spent a lot of time in media in general,
Yep.
sometimes you just network and you sort of ride the wave of saying, okay, this is something that there's a good synergy here, to use a buzzword. And I think that's what we had
Right.
from those days. And just
Right.
like you have, we all have with the other team members. And so yeah, and like now, and I don't know if you want to talk about now,
I just want to ask you. So you like maybe like me, I will tell you that, before I started Unfound, I listened to a few of the episodes of the Maura Murray podcast, and maybe I listened to a few like Generation Y podcasts. Of course, although I haven't talked to either of those for over kind of a long time. I kind of got to know those guys at least a little bit. But that was really all of the true crime listening I did even before I started Unfound. I think that's why Unfound is so unique. Kind of the same for you then, before you got involved with me and Unfound.
yeah, I was probably less, to use the buzzwords, less brand specific and more just generally listening to what I was doing. And frankly, there was some time in those days, just like now, where I was also keeping up on some, and it wasn't just politics, it was also just sort of, crime, or it was just other sorts of trends, sort of current stuff. And kind of, I don't want to use the word amazed because it wasn't that, but interested in seeing play out. Maybe part of this too was just because of my interest in communication in general, how things were getting covered real time with streaming, both audio and video. And I'll use an example, and this isn't to get political, it's just to use an example with everyone's political views. Remember the Occupy protests and all that, and whatever one thinks of that, it was kind of interesting that as that played out, if you remember, a lot of that was seen from the ground. People had live streaming. They were, and again, some of that was very biased, quote unquote, reporting, which is fine. It was very, but then there were some people trying to just cover what they see and then gather different views. And that's one example where we were seeing with the net, the pros and cons of how that sort of real time citizen journalism, right, that term was playing out. That was very interesting to me. I didn't always take a deep academic interest in it, but as a citizen, it was interesting to see that sort of direct engagement that was going on. Now we can get into all sorts of discussion about the pros and cons of that and spectacle and how interested are people, but it is interesting to see how all that was playing out. And I was thinking to myself, just like now, and we talk about this and on the ground, these tools that we have, social media, streaming, all this sort of data that's out there, we should be constantly challenging ourselves to really do the work of all the positive ways of using this, of course, in our context, particularly to raise awareness about missing persons cases and so forth. So part of that is my attention was on sort of that stuff too. And so that was interesting to me, as it still is in some ways. Yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you ever came across Unfound? Do you remember how that happened?
Well, I would have to look at the documentary evidence. I would have to say it was around November of 2016. I don't know for sure because I reached out to you. And I said, are you the guy doing your new Unfound program, more or less? So I caught that episode toward the tail end of 2016. And then, as you indicated, our communication was spilling there pretty regularly into 2017. So it would have been around that time. And then that's when I was probably then starting to, quote unquote, tune in a little bit more to what was out there, both to get some specificity to see what's going on and to think to myself probably at some level, if one were to pursue this more, because it was already a couple of years there that I was doing some research,
Yeah.
and maybe dabbling a little bit, maybe, you know, with some attempts I had at some social media or blogs to mention some cases, but never really pushed it deeply, but thinking a little bit more about output. So I was sort of scanning what was going on out there. And I don't remember how I came across Unfound per se, whether it was through a search or through some social media post or you or someone shared it. But there it was, and then I reached out to you.
It's interesting because, you know, I remember it's probably, I agree with you. It had to have been probably late 2016. And then you appeared as a guest, I think maybe around April of
Yeah, it was the
2017 or
springest. Yeah.
something like that. And what's interesting about that, of course, at the time, Unfound had no social media presence whatsoever. There was no Facebook discussion group. There was no page. There was no
Right.
website. There was nothing. There was no YouTube channel or anything else. And still, somehow you ran into Unfound,
Yep.
somehow, some way. Do you remember, you know, I know you sent me that original message and everything, but at that time, did you know I was, did it come up like that I was also from Western Pennsylvania? We went to the same school. Is that something we happened upon. I don't even remember how that all came up.
It would have to have been. And through the other type of programming that you did, I had noticed that you graduated from Grove City, but we, as we've indicated before, we didn't know each other before that. So I was somehow, through your other programming that you had done, it was sort of residually out there on the net. Obviously, I saw, oh, this guy went to Grove City. And I think then through our conversations that we figured more of the Western Pennsylvania connection.
Just wondered if
And that
that
helps.
so
Again, we didn't know that, but again, back to just networking and rapport building, when you find those commonalities, those are great springboards, you know, to build rapport. Yep.
And but I want to make clear that Eric is not an assistant simply because he went to the same school that I did
Oh,
or
right.
from Western Pennsylvania. Has nothing to do, of course, with any of that. And you know, the fact is, I mean, you know, to be totally honest, you know, regarding Grove City, I'm probably, people get to know me as the way I, of course, vision Grove City. And, you know, I've had a lot of complaints about my years there. I'm probably the mo you know, the opposite of a person maybe you would think would go do gone to have gro gone, you know, gone to Grove City, probably. I don't know if Grove City's really in the business of creating people who go into true crime and host podcasts or anything. But that's what I ended up doing, and like I've been in entertainment or anything. So, you know, it's just a very you know, very interesting concept. People meet me. You went to Grove City? Yeah, I did, believe it or not. Yeah, that's where I went. So there's that. Okay, so you were on, of course, you came on Donna Michalenko, and of course, unfortunately, she is still missing. I want to talk a little bit more. You'd mentioned it already, this cold case web. How did this get started? This was well before you were on Unfound, but what is this? What was the idea with it, and what is it?
So sometime, and again, I can't remember if it was 2015 or 2016 right now at the top of my head, but I was thinking conceptually, you know, if I'm going to have an outlet to do this, you know, it's good to have some idea, brand identity. And then the reality is to, in the internet world, you want to have a URL if you're going to do something. Now, I had reserved the URL and probably some of the similar URLs to, and I don't remember exactly when around that time and think, okay, I'm going to use this at some point, which I did. And I started to get some content going there. Unfortunately, it was a nice feature site for some recommended resources linked back to Unfound and some other sites. And it's helpful and it gained a little search traction, but I never really consistently did enough with it. But the concept's been out there long enough that it's out there. And of course, if even the hashtag coldcaseweb.com, which, you know, you don't, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a trademark lawyer, but, you know, hashtags generally aren't quote unquote owned, but they develop a certain identity. And so, you know, I've been able to kind of keep that going. And, you know, and so with that and using that concept in social media, I sort of have that position. So what I decided to do last year is I switched, I've taken the site, the URL, and I've started transitioning over to a Substack. Now, I really haven't been pushing it much, a lot yet, but what I plan to do with that is keep some of the same spirit of it, recommending quality resources, but then start doing some posts and maybe some of the other options on Substack, but then also at the same time, use some of those other social media outlets or YouTube or whatever to maybe push out some audio content, whether it's collaborative or my own. Again, I'm off schedule, but the site's viable. It's a good way for folks to also just kind of see what my interests are. And it has some identity. It has some visibility. Not enough, but it is something. My idea on that, and this goes back to what we talked about years ago, it's not just me posting stuff, although that's going to be part of it. I also had this idea of some collaboration, Cold Case Web, and maybe not just featuring quality content from other people, curating some of my own content, but also maybe using that content to network, collaborate, those sorts of things. Who knows in the future, you know, the kind of ideas where that could take, whether it ends up just being a very active site. I've even thought recently, and I'm not saying I'm necessarily going to do this, but who knows, in the next phase of my life, could the concept become some sort of media entity or production company specifically tied to, you know, a serious opportunity to feature and highlight cold case journalistic work. Time will tell.
Okay. Let's move on to this. Now, not only were you a guest, and you, of course, you were the guest with the Donna Michalenko disappearance, but you've actually have collaborated with some other guests. And of course, we do not want to go into any specifics, because this would be private and everything else, but you have worked with, you know, over the last few years, maybe not recently, but maybe in the past, for Fuse, Fran Masucci, of course, the daughter of Nicholas Masucci, and then also Joe Kistner, who was a guest on Unfound for a couple different disappearances. So why don't you talk, once again, I know you can't go deep into that, but you know, what are you trying to do, and you know, what can you say about that?
Yeah, so let me start with Joe and then get to the Masucci case. Joe reached out to me, great guy, and because of he heard the Donna episode, and then of course, you know, and I don't know exactly how he got onto Unfound, but he's a listener.
Yeah,
again, eventually a guest on two episodes.
Yep,
and he reached out to me, and we've really began a good collaboration. And he has some of his own stuff going, Shadows of the Midwest, shadowsofthemidwest.com. Yep. But he and I have some collaboration going, particularly on one murder case. And we're talking a lot and trading ideas on all sorts of things. Great guy. And so that's one example, you know, where just the Unfound became a crossroads. On the Masucci case, now, I'm a team member.
And it should be let's go back to Joe one more second. Now, it also helps. He's kind of the same United part of the United States. He's in Minnesota, right? And you're right next door in North Dakota, right?
He's in Minnesota, yep.
All right.
So, he's in Minnesota, and he's, you know, one state over.
Right.
And that was also, again, a good sort of common bridge when he reached out to me for that, again, rapport building.
Yes.
Now, on the... I don't remember exactly when I joined the Unfound team, but I was not, and I always clarify this with people because I share the Masucci episode, but I tell people I was not part of that episode.
Like, right, you is not.
Unlike
That's
the
right. you were not.
Cam Renner, I helped with research. Blah,
yep,
blah, blah.
You did.
I was. There was nothing like that with the Masucci.
Zero. That's right.
It was an episode like others that I heard from you, but I said this one really resonated with me. And so I just started doing a little bit of my own research, old media reports, different ways of searching government files. You know, again, eventually it was more public than it is now that Fran and I had collaborated, especially around the time of we released those FBI files that I got through FOIA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, through some other networking and sourcing and ongoing research, that's probably the case that I think the most about. Now, there's still a lot to study in that case. And I will mention here too, because it's not public, a Mike Green, who's a relative of the Masucci's, he's writing a book about Nick's life. So he's not just interested in the disappearance, but he and I spend a lot of collaborative time. He's out there in Jersey. And so we got a lot of heavy research going. And that case, we spend a lot of time thinking about. And, you know, there's some background sources that we have and some documents that we're constantly looking at and studying, you know, as we've talked about, as much of the context of New Jersey, New York, Florida in the 1970s and 60s, yeah. Really get an understanding of how that might have played out, that disappearance. A lot of work to do on that still. That's probably the case that I think the most about because of that ongoing collaboration. Again, collaboration is key. How often do I say that?
Yeah. Right. Now, what I remember also is very early on after that episode came out, you and Fran, I started working together, and you ended up finding this woman who kind of had a thing with Nick way back in the 70s, right? She had not been able to find him, and you were able to find her here in Florida or somewhere, right?
Yeah. Yep. So this was, you know, in your episode, this very interesting story that Fran told.
Yeah.
And about this sort of, you know, this woman that this person, this agent, whoever, and had on this card, and that, you know, in my conversations with Fran, then that led to some collaborative discussion and then some research where eventually we did found that woman and that was a significant aspect of that in terms of forward movement and understanding. Yeah.
Right. That was somebody she'd been trying to find for years and you were able to track her down and have a conversation with her. Now I want to go back. So this guy's name is Nick Green.
Mike Green.
All right. Is he related to Nick Masucci, or is this just something independent, or who is this guy?
He's related to the Masucci's. My understanding is just talking to Mike that that's something he was from the area, but he had discovered eventually his relationship to the Masucci family. Documented. It's not some speculative thing. And he's been very much a very proactive, strong point of contact. And he's working on this book project about Nick's life as a whole. So his interest isn't only the disappearance. Of course, right. The disappearance is significant, but he's working on a book about the life of Nick Masucci.
All right, let's move on to this. Now, this is a little bit of jest, but it's kind of serious too. Obviously, you know, we're about almost an hour into this interview. Obviously, people find out Eric, smart guy, very logical guy and everything. But there is something that I have to ask you about that's a little amazing to me. And I know we've kind of different on it. And it kind of comes to my mind even when I mention you and Joe Kistner getting together. But you are a big follower of like cults, like researching cults, kind of that 70s, 80s, yeah. Kind of this, you know, was it pandemonium? Was it real or something like that? But I know Joe has talked about it with me, yeah. And you also have talked about it with me, you know, kind of me, I don't know what to think of that, but where does that come from? You know, how does that fit into everything that you've talked about so far?
So I know as a citizen and as an educator, we always have to be careful about claims of conspiracy or claims of fantastical things. However, there is the reality in human history. We could go through a number of sources or incidents where sometimes there are strange things that happen. I'm not talking supernatural. I'm just talking things where people coordinate. And sometimes, by the way, the truth is hiding in plain sight. It's yep. Not always the back room.
That's true.
So this is not the first lead in for this for me, but an example would be, and we talked about this on Donna's episode, you know, a source at the time had said, you know, hey, take a look at the book by Mari Terry in terms of some of the cult activity that was discussed, you know, that did involve North Dakota. Now, you can take the book by Mari Terry and you can break it apart and you can disagree with aspects of that book, right? But the reality is that, you know, there was activity, and that book was The Ultimate Evil. but there was activity in North Dakota. Now, I don't know for sure, and I'm still very skeptical of whether this had anything to do with Donna's disappearance, mm-hmm. but understand, because some of that happened later, okay?
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that whether that had anything to do with Son of Sam or whatever, that there were pockets of people in North Dakota and elsewhere who had beliefs that were cultish or cult beliefs. Some of them also happened to be involved in criminal activity.
Okay.
Right? So there's a lead in there. It's like, whether they're in cults or not, they were using that framework, some of them, that had criminal connections. Right. Okay. So that could pique one's interest. So that's just one example. So, for instance, other cases, you know, sometimes you run into something where there might be some anomaly or something that's unexplained, where you have to say, is there and again, we have in law, and I'm not a lawyer, but the notion of conspiracy, right? People who collaborate to do something they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
Like, just like in the case of Nick's case, Masucci, well, it's highly likely that Nick's disappearance was tied to organized crime. Well,
yeah.
If it's an organized crime disappearance, someone conspired to say, unfortunately, this guy's got to go. So whether you're talking about cults, or you're talking about organized crime, or you're talking about rogue government people or whatever, right? If there's reasonable evidence and analysis that said that should be looked at, it should be looked at. But just like you, I would always say one has to be very cautious to make sure that you have a path that's not fantastical, flimsy, sensationalistic. It's just saying that we got to be open to where the evidence might lead.
You know, I guess, although like as everybody knows, you're maybe 3 or 4 years younger than I am, but I'm old enough to remember like the cult, you know, scares of like the early, those even happened in Leechburg, where I can remember talking to my friends and, you know, there's some rumor that it's like cult members with hoods were running, you know, through the woods and things like that. And of course there have been books that have written about that. You could even say maybe like a movie like the Blair Witch Project kind of drew some inspiration from that to create that movie in 1999. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, ask you about that. Of course, I don't think we've covered any disappearances where, you know, a cult or something has been, maybe like Sean Dickerson, it's maybe believed he might have gone off and joined one, but that's a different type of cult than maybe what we're thinking, you know, when I think about like doing sacrifices in the woods and things. But that's why I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, I think we always have to be very cautious with evidence and analysis. But we also have to say, you know, if we're going to keep possibilities on the table, exclude it if it's flimsy, exclude it if it's sensationalistic. But the reality is that people use organizations, groups at times to either perpetuate and or cover up bad activity.
So here for now we're early 2024.
Yes.
Just to some of the things that you personally regarding true crime on your own, what are some of the things that you have planned for yourself for 2024?
Okay, well, I'm not going to let this moment go without mentioning that we're past 30 episodes coming up. We'll be, you know, working on episode 31
on the ground. Yep. Unfound on the ground. Yep.
Which is, if I just may mention, a brief summary is that during COVID, we on the team with you were thinking about what are some things that we want to do for engagement. It wasn't only about COVID, but certainly that sort of digital remote situation did get us to think about, and we came up with the Unfound on the Ground concept. And so I think the episode 30, which will be released at some point in February, was our review episode. We'll look back on some key moments and so forth. Mm-hmm. We're moving forward on that. We've made improvements on that program thanks to your guidance as well as listener feedback.
Sure.
And so that's going to continue, which is beneficial to Unbound. It helps me out to be a better public communicator. And again, thanks to Unfound, helps me to continue my own sort of professional reputation. Number two, going to continue with very strong collaboration on the Masucci case, waiting on some additional research and networking on that. Number three, I'm kind of diving back into some aspects of Donna's case that either A, I've let go for a while, or B, some things have piqued my attention. Maybe Joe will jump in a little on that. Time will tell, but definitely going to work on that. And there's a few other cases I don't want to mention because I'm not sure how much time I'll get. But those are three priorities. I'll mention the priorities, and plus, of course, the on the ground. So excited about that for 2024. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think with that commitment to what we have in common, you know, truth, resolve, accuracy, avoiding sensationalism, there's a lot of junk out there. You know, there's a lot of hype, not just in true crime, but really in a lot of genres. Yeah. We just have to continue to cut through that and be focused on seeking truth.
Okay. Now, I've asked so far, I've asked the other two the listeners should know, I've already interviewed Carrie and I've interviewed Emily, and I asked them both these two questions. And so you get the same two questions. You're allowed to expound on them. They just doesn't have to be yes or no or whatever. You can certainly give an explanation for each of your answers. First question, what happened? And I realize you are not an expert necessarily on either one of these, just your understanding. Totally fine. What happened to Tom Brown?
You know, I'm not comfortable answering that specifically what happened. Yeah.
Okay. All right. He's going to say, all right, that's fine. Doesn't want to offer up an opinion. Not going to say. Second question, did Steve Pankey kill Janelle Matthews?
Again, I'm not willing to go on public record giving an answer to that, if that's okay.
Okay. All right. All right. Just so you know, Gary and Emily gave their answers, but that's totally fine. Just want to see, you know, taking the kind of the temperature of the room on these things. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this is to show that, you know, we don't do groupthink here at Unfound. This isn't we're just talking about cults. This isn't just our little cult where everybody has to think the same and everything else. It's very much the opposite. I do know that there are other podcasts where there are people helping where that's certainly expected, that everybody just follows the host and whatever the host thinks. That's not what we do here. Everybody's
in fact,
allowed.
As I mentioned, one of the benefits of our group is that it's about the refinement of ideas. Right. It's about throwing ideas off thing. It's about, of course, sometimes that has to keep folks on track, but it is really about getting at the truth. It's not, you know, I feel good because I now agree with Ed. Yes. It's okay, what are we trying to achieve here? Even when some of us are giving Ed advice about making the program better or building the outreach, you know, the advice isn't always going to be feel good advice. So it's very much not like that group thing, which is why we're able to, and I'm just as an example, thinking of the extensive conversations we had about the Cam Remmer case.
Yep.
We looked at the possibilities and wrangled a bit at this and that. And I still believe, and I've said this publicly, that's a Hall of Fame episode, right? If there's a Hall of Fame episode for Unfound, it's the Cam Remmer episode. What did that go? 3 hours and 15 minutes?
It was long. It was pretty long, 4 hours or something.
Quality. But I know, not just me, not just you, but others, the effort and the focus that went into that, including some of those discussions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not copping out on your two questions. I'm just not comfortable taking a position on those two. That's okay.
It's just, once again, just opinions. There's no defaming or anything going on here, but I thought I would give you an opportunity, being that those probably are the two most well-known episodes that Unfound, obviously for very, very, very different reasons. Okay. Yeah. Eric, anything you want to say before we complete this interview?
I want to encourage listeners to share, you know, the Unfound programs. Also to think about Unfound as a sort of digital library or resource, right? It's because this is really about resources and getting material out there. But also continue to stay interactive with Ed and the team, all of us, and the different programming that's available through the platform. Of course, the episodes themselves, the actual Friday episodes are the most. That's the flagship of the flagship, so to speak. But then the other programming we have, the live show, the get, you know, join the think tank, and also with it goes with that participation in Unfound on the Ground, but then of course listening later. The Facebook page. So stay active. Think about ways that this could be a sort of collaborative platform. And if you have suggestions on cases, get it to Ed or the team members, because there's always, and as I always say with a lot of these cases, someone out there knows something or knows someone who knows something.
I am going to ask you one more question. This is, you can answer this one though, just because we're both from Western Pennsylvania and everybody, you know, has surely heard of this. Permane Brothers sandwiches, excellent or overrated?
Excellent. I love them. And again, maybe there's a strong hometown bias there, but not every time I go back to do I get them, but I will say it's something I at least try to keep in my social rotation of places to go. Again, not necessarily every year, but I always keep it on the list, and they are excellent.
Okay, and everybody doesn't know what those are. Permane Brothers sandwiches, they put everything in the bread. So if you get coleslaw, it's in the sandwich. You get french fries, it's in the sandwich. If you get like a ham sandwich, the french fries and the coleslaw and everything are in the bread. I don't know if they came up with that originally, but it's a well-known Pittsburgh icon, you know, iconic restaurant chain in Pittsburgh. And I think I will go the other way. I think they're overrated, but that's totally fine because we don't do groupthink, do we, Eric?
We don't do groupthink, although it would be great someday if we were ever to do a Western PA Unfound meetup to meet the Manny Brothers and then folks can decide for themselves.
Yes. Okay. That's right. Eric, thank you for doing this interview. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Keep up the good work and get ready, folks, for a great 2024. Yeah. Unfound, and be well, folks.
And that was my January 23rd, 2024 interview with Eric, the assistant who started out as a guest. And yes, I'm still a bit weirded out by he and I being at the same school at the same time, but not knowing each other and meeting up then finally 25 years later. What a coincidence. I hope you enjoyed our talk. Next Monday, March 11th, you will hear from Cherie, and that will be the last team episode. I'm Ed Densel, and you've been listening to a special episode of Unfound.